Thank you, Dick. That was really nice. My name's Denny, and I'm an alcoholic. That's the best news I got for you. Oh, and it's great to see my friend Lee here. Oh, my God. You know, I wish you guys were with me last night about 10:30, 11 o'clock, as I was trying to fall asleep for a 4 o'clock wake-up this morning. I gave the best talk of my life, you know. And as long as I'm thanking people, let me go right back to the beginning here. I want to thank a guy named Bill Wilson. And Dr. Bob. Let's just start there. I mean, those two guys getting together. We're all sitting here on a Thursday night. Just imagine us if we were in some damn bar somewhere, you know. I have a lot of people to thank. I think the first one I really should thank after Bill and Bob is my wife. 3 days ago, we celebrated 52 years of marriage. She still hasn't figured it out. You know what's beautiful? You know, as most of us do, we come in here pretty crushed up. And I met my wife a long time ago, and we got married. And she married one guy, and then another guy showed up. Then another guy showed up, you know. And I got a chance through what I get from you guys to give her back the guy that she married, you know. That's what we do around here. I'm so overpaid. I am so overpaid. And as long as we're thanking people, it's great to see my dear friend Bob and Linda here in the front row. We've known each other for a long time, and they're right behind us, a year behind us in marital bliss, although he's got a lot more time than I do. I'll be 28 years sober January the 2nd. And, it's the only place where you get applause for running out of a burning building, you know. and boy, I'll tell you, it was on fire. So, you know, and while I am thanking people for this new life that I've been given so freely and so wonderfully, I have to thank my first sponsor, a man named Scott Redman. Some of you knew Scott. He's no longer with us. And he just saw me come in and handed me this program on a silver platter. You couldn't miss it. Even a drummer like I am couldn't miss this thing, you know. He made it so easy to accept what was in front of me. And my present-day sponsor, a man named Steve Abrams, and his sponsor is a man named Father Terry. So I've really been blessed with wonderful, wonderful people in my life, in my sober life especially. And when Scott was sponsored by Dr. Paul Lowe, and I got to know Dr. Paul quite well the last couple of years of his life, and guys like Sandy Beach and Bob. I mean, it's pretty hard to miss it when you have people like that around you. And to see the faces out here, man, this is the faces. I don't care how tired I am, how hungry I am, how lonely, how sad I am. I come to an AA meeting and I feel better because I'm home. I'm home. And every time Dick calls me, we chat. We chat a lot about music, but, you know, the underlying current is that rhythm of sobriety, and it really is the rhythm of sobriety. And it breaks my heart to see. I come from a family of sponsees and sponsors. We went over the top a little bit. Scott really went over the top with a lot of stuff, and I learned from him, and you know, if I'm doing my job in AA, I'm sponsoring many more men than I can really handle. I mean, you're not working with them every day, all the time, you know. But if I figure if I'm not sponsoring 20 guys, I'm not doing my job in AA. And that's what this thing is about. It's that one drunk talking to another. That's the miracle around here. That truly is the miracle around here. Now, if you see one guy sitting by himself, one drunk talking to himself, stay away from him. That's not a good. But I love everything about this. I've had some really great things happen in my life. this is the best one. And my wife will even take a second seat to this, because we wouldn't be together. I wouldn't be doing anything. And life just keeps getting better and better and sweeter and sweeter. It's all about love and service. Dr. Bob said it. Two words. Bang. There it is. Well, let me start from the beginning. It's nice being here. Oh, my God, is this beautiful down here. Lake Lanier. Wow. I mean, the ride in from the airport was gorgeous. Charles brought us in. Is Charles here tonight? Where are you, Charles? He's probably still driving speakers around. About love and service, you know. And I met Jackie at the airport, and of course, Mildred, of course. We've met before, but it's just so nice to be home with a bunch of people that I know have the same background and same past as me. Different, but same. So let me tell you a little bit about my story. I'm from eastern Pennsylvania, which is very similar to Poconos. We lived on the foothills of the Poconos, shall we say. And I came from a family with no alcoholism in my family whatsoever, none. We were deeply, deeply immersed in the church. My father was a deacon. My grandfather was an elder. My mother was the church secretary. My sister, my brother, and my grandmother all sang on the church choir. And the best I could do was to steal money out of the collection plate. I had 13 years of perfect attendance growing up. You know, they give you a round pin for the first year, and then they put bars under it. I used to walk with a little list, you know. 13 years of perfect attendance. That's Sunday school and church. So I figured a way to get the seventh tradition from the Sunday school groups and collect it. And I would just get all our seventh traditions, take it down to the church office where my mom was a secretary, and I would count it up, make the little report. And sometimes I would take a quarter. And I would go across the street. I'd have a smoke and a Coke and wait for the damn thing to be over. Then I'd have to sit with my granddad in the back of the church and keep him awake. So every once in a while, granddad was the only one that drank. My dad had maybe three times a year he'd have a drink, you know. But my granddad, maybe four or five times a year, between Sunday school and church, he would run down in his 55 Plymouth, he'd run down to the Legion home and have a shot and a beer. And whenever that happened, he would fall asleep in the church service. So when he fell asleep in the church service, then the choir loft would come to life, and they'd say, wake him up, wake him up, wake. And I just wanted to be granddad, you know. So I was a fun kid. Dick alluded to, I'm a drummer. So ever since I'm 13, I'm working in the gin mills. And that's what they called them up there anyway. And sometimes we'd get home at 3:30 in the morning after a Saturday night job, and my mom would come in and kick the bed in the morning and say, get up, you're going to church, damn it. I said, no, isn't that a mixed message, Mom? So I'd get up and do my thing and go to church. And fun-loving kid. I was in with all the right kids at school. In fact, I had that much fun in the 11th grade, they asked me to stay back a year and show all the other kids how to have that much fun before getting out of school. It was a fun time, and they were about to draft me for Vietnam. And I said, ooh, better not give me a gun. I'm not responsible enough to have a gun. I'll shoot one of our guys. So I heard about this Navy School of Music program, and I auditioned for it. I went to Washington, D.C., and got in it. Now, I should tell you a little bit about the drinking. See, I when I was 13 working these gin mills, one of the older guys, maybe 40 years old, said, somebody get the kid a drink, okay? They had to get special dispensation that I could play in some of these bars, because you had to be 21. So they bring me this red fizzy thing. Yeah, when you're 13 years old, a red fizzy thing is going to, you know, yeah, bam, slammed it down. It was slow gin fizz, you know. Some here by mistake, actually. But, you know, I didn't run out and get a case of it. And it was all harmless kind of drinking when I was a teenager. And, you know, we'd steal a quart of beer out of this bar out in the country while the guy's in the back making crab patty sandwiches or something. We'd take a beer out of his, his cooler, and we'd run out in the woods and chug it down and go back to the Friday night dance and throw up on the girls, you know. I mean, it was all very harmless. Alcohol didn't, I didn't have any of that fun with problems things for many, 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 many years. Now I'm in the Navy. I get into the Navy, and they send, well, back home, the typical, you know, eastern Pennsylvania's people worked in the coal mines, or the anthracite coal mines, or the Bethlehem steel mills. These were hard people, tough lives. And on the way home from work, they would stop at the tavern, and they'd have a shot and a beer. You know, a shot was, I think it was 35 cents got you a little Christian Brothers brandy and a short beer. And if you had another 15 cents in your pocket, they'd give you a slice of hot bologna and a hard-boiled egg pickled in red beet juice. Well, after that, you had enough gas to fly to Cleveland, you know. But for $5, you could lose your car, and I did a couple of times. So it was still, it was all harmless kind of drinking, you know. Now they send me down to South America on a goodwill tour. So you slap a white uniform on a kid, we're in a band, we're down there playing concerts and what have you. Take us out to sea for a couple of weeks and then cut us loose in a foreign country, in a strange city. Yeah, we promoted some goodwill, I'll tell you. And, you know, down there I learned how to drink a little vino tinto and a little vino rojo and some pisco sours, you know. So it was a fun time. I'm young. I'm having fun. Then my last job in the Navy, I got sent to the south of France on the French Riviera. We got an admiral over there, the admiral of the 6th Fleet, Mediterranean Fleet. He had a band because we played for dignitaries and what have you. So when we were in our home port, we used to get, which is Villefranche. Villefranche is a little sleepy little town right on the ocean between Nice, France, and Monaco. Doesn't get any better than that. It really doesn't. And we used to get up in the morning, raise the flag. I don't know what they call it in that Navy stuff. But, you know, they put the flag up, and we played a Star Spangled Banner. And the right around the, we were parked, what do you call it, anchored or whatever. Just we weren't tied up. We were in the water, you know. And the tourists had these expensive hotel rooms, and so it used to kind of bug them that they had to get up early when we were playing the Star Spangled Banner. So they asked the admiral if we could not do that. So he thought about it, and he said, you know what? You guys, when we're in home port, you play when we were around the Mediterranean. In home port, though, you don't have to do that. I'm going to give you guys 4 days off at a time. So we had what they call 96s, 96 hours. We all pooled together the little bit of money we had, and we got some really cheap little apartment in Nice where we could just go hang out, you know. And then we learned how to drink some Chateau Neuf du Pape and some Nuit Saint-Georges, some Saint-Estèphe, you know. So here we are, like, living on bread, wine, cheese, you know, like. And it was fun. I was working in jazz clubs at night. I found some people over there. And I met my wife, had studied in, she learned English in school in England, although she's French, but she was back in France and wanted to keep her English skills alive, so we met each other one night and had coffee. And we hit it off, and she didn't know I was in the Navy. I had civilian clothing. We lived in a dumpy apartment with some other buddies of mine, you know. And I'd play the jazz clubs at night, and every once in a while, I'd just like, where'd he go? You know, we go around the Mediterranean. I had the uniform on. So we got engaged. We fell in love, got engaged. And came time, I was in 4 years, 1 month, 70 days, 11 hours, and 39 minutes. But who's keeping track? It came time to get out. And I just bought her a ring. I bought her a ring on the ship store. It was $130, you know. That was the second one I bought. So anyway, we get engaged, and it's time to go home. And I say, oh, by the way, I'm leaving in a couple of weeks. I'm going back to the States. She says, we just got engaged. Why are you leaving? She says, I'm in the Navy. You're in the Navy? She had no idea. So anyway, I went home. I got a job, and we did all the paperwork to start bringing her over. She came over and went into New York City to start my career. Now, I got into New York City, and I start meeting all my heroes. And these guys are so wasted, man. They're drunk. They have needles hanging out their arms. I mean, it was pretty scary. And I said, well, if that's what you have to do to make that kind of music, where do I go to get some, you know? I was all in. I was just all in. So I started my career there, and I worked at a famous old jazz club where you made no money. We made like $100 a week. I'm talking late 60s. $100 a week. You're there 6 hours a night, six nights a week. But you're playing with the masters. You're playing with the cream of the crop. And Sunday nights, when the shows and different things were off, a lot of the guys would come down to see who's the new kid in town. So they'd see me playing with the masters. And I started doing the better work, which was the recording sessions. So I'd start doing like a 9 o'clock TV commercial, and then a 10 o'clock TV commercial, a radio jingle, or something, 11 o'clock. You could book them one per hour. And we'd show up at work, and the ad agency guys would bring booze for us, 9 o'clock in the morning. And they brought some other kind of stimulants, too, every once in a while. You know. But they said, now, here's everything you guys need. Now give us some magic. And we did. And so we'd do a couple of jingles in the morning. In the afternoon, we'd go 2 to 5, and then a 7 to 10 record date. Now, the record dates, they brought more and better booze and more and better stimulants, too, if you know what I mean. So here we are making records that are still on the radio today, and half of us weren't even there. I mean, you were gone after a while. Then this guy from England came to town. This guy just left the biggest band in history, let's say. And he came to New York to make a record, and because I was in that herd, I was one of the top 10 guys that got the studio calls. He looked at all of them very discreetly under the table, and he just liked my attitude, my vibe. And he hired me to do this record right after he left this huge group. The record was a huge success. Now my career cannot get any better. And I'm seeing light at the end of the tunnel. I know my ship came in, and I didn't go to the airport to meet it this time, you know. So I'm feeling good about myself, and the record's going right to number one and everything. Like 3 months after it's out, he calls us up and he said, would you and your wife like to take a little vacation? And I said, a vacation I could use. It was long, 18-hour days most weeks. And he said, why don't you bring your wife and come on over to England and just hang out for a little bit. We'll celebrate the record and just have a vacation. I thought, oh, great. I'd love to see him and hang out. We can go down to France, see my wife's family and everything. Yeah, we'll be there. So we pack up and we go to England. Actually, he had a place in Scotland. We were up in Scotland. And while we were there, he said, I miss my old band. Do you want to form a band? Now, here's where alcoholism comes into the picture. Do we have any people here that are under a year? There's a few. Okay, well, I want to tell you people something. Yes. Big time. Welcome. But I want to tell you newer people, you possess what we call the alcoholic brain. Don't use it for a while. Just give us a shot at this puppy, okay? Now, I didn't know that I had an alcoholic brain because I hadn't crossed the line yet. So now here this man says to me, would you like to form a band? And the alcoholic brain goes, yes, you know. It's just screaming at me. All I heard was a cash register, and I ka-chung, you know. And I didn't know that I should have been a little more thorough about accepting this position. So I said, yes. So that was my first mistake, listening to the alcoholic brain. And we go back to New York, pack everything up, sell everything. and we move over to England to start this band with this big shot. You know. Now we're touring Europe and touring England, and we're selling out. There's millions of dollars floating around. The records are selling millions of records. And we made an agreement based on a hippie handshake. It was done in those days, but the alcoholic brain told me, that's cool. That's cool. I can trust this guy. Millions of dollars, not so cool. So we were all to be part owners of this huge band. It was one of, if not the biggest band of the 70s, I'm told. I didn't feel like it was, but that's what the numbers say. And so now I'm waiting for the money to come in, but because he had some other problems with his prior band and legal issues and everything, our money was kind of tied up, and we were living on retainers, let's say, and we weren't getting our, especially the kind of money I was used to making in New York. So it was getting tough. And as it got tougher, the guys would come over to my place at night, and the drinking seemed to change a little bit. It was no longer, let's come on, let's have some fun, you know. Now it's fun with problems, and we're drinking to get rid of some things that were distasteful at the time. So I stuck it out 2-3 years, something like that, and the money still wasn't right, and the vibe was just getting better. It went from a family band, everybody all in, all for fun, all for one. It went to like, what's going on? You're all right, but we ain't, you know. And the drinking would start to change, and the guys would get drunk. And so it was it's getting bad. And what happened was I had a friend of mine, one of the guys in the band, came back from Scotland and told me another bad piece of information about the business end of the deal. And I listened to my alcoholic brain again. It told me, I know how to handle this. Just leave. Just leave. So I said, all right, I'm going to just leave. There was a car in front of my place in London. It was taking me to the airport. We were flying off to Lagos, Nigeria, to make his biggest selling record. And we'd been rehearsing this for months, and so it was all set to go. Now, I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, like, one of my character defects is I'm a retaliator. If you get me, I'm going to get you back, you know. I'll bide my time, but I'm getting you back. So I had to inflict a little pain on the way out. So the car's in front of my place to take me to the airport, and I said, listen to the alcoholic brain one more time. I said, I'm out of here. Picked up the phone, and I called him, and I said, I can't do this anymore. Slam dunked him. That was the night that I gave birth to my alcoholism, right then and there, because I had given birth to my very first resentment. Resentment, the number one offender, it has the power to kill us, you know, like taking poison and expecting someone else to die, all of those things. Well, every drink I took from that phone call on was at him. I'll show you. I'll kill myself. Slowly. You know, brilliant mind of the alcoholic. Don't know what to do. I don't want to go back to New York, that rat race. It's too hard. I always wanted to come to California and play with the large studio orchestras that record the music for the movies, the soundtracks, and what have you. So I said to my wife, come on, let's go to California. They'll open their doors wide. We'll just get right back into the studio world. Everything's going to be great. So we come out to California, and California's music biz said, who the hell are you? And who sent for you? Now I got two resentments. I don't know about you, but when I have a resentment, I usually don't know what to do, so I drink at it. I just pour some alcohol on it. And that's exactly what I did. My wife started working. She started as a receptionist. 30 years later, she retired as a vice president of Wells Fargo Construction Lending, because she had to carry a drunk with her. That's what we do. And I was... and God bless her, though. I'm glad she stuck it out. And it was tough. All I could do was go to this bar because I couldn't feel what I was feeling. I had to be numbed out. I would just get up, and this bar opened at 10:40 in the morning. 10:40? Who's a rocket scientist? So I'd be up there at 10:40, you know, I'd have my burrito in hand. I'd go in and have a burrito and a beer, and at noon I wanted to be drinking Stoli or cognac. I don't want to feel what I'm feeling. It just got worse and worse and worse. I worked a little bit. In fact, I had a buddy of mine that lived up in the Hollywood Hills. He had a jingle studio, and he'd call me, and I'd go over there a lot, record a little spot. As soon as he was done with me, I would just like sneak out and go back to the bar. Didn't know what else to do. I needed to drink, and I couldn't stop. This one day, he had me up there. We were doing some Jack-in-the-Box commercials or something like that, you know. And I left. I thought he was done with me, and I go over to the bar. And he calls the bar, and he said, "Is Denny there?" He said, "Yeah, he just walked in." He said, "Well, send him back. I'm not done with him yet." You know, that's the way it was, you know. And so I was so bitter. This resentment just ate me alive. And the only way I could stand to live with it was, thank God, I could drink. Now I realize, I think I got a drinking problem here. And it's funny, my wife would come home a little bit later every night, you know what I mean? So if she'd get home after 6:30, 7 o'clock, maybe I'd be passed out, blacked out on the chair. That was the end of a perfect day for her. Because it wasn't pretty, it really wasn't pretty. And I'd wake up 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning and realize, I've done it again. I don't want to live like this, but I don't know how not to. And I'd slither into bed, try not to wake her up. And she'd get up at 5:30 in the morning to go to work, and could never figure out how a woman made so much noise just getting dressed, you know. And it was just enough to wake my sorry butt up, you know. And she'd shoot me that look. Some of you guys know what that look is, you know. Not a pretty look. So I said, well, I better do something about this. Now, in Los Angeles, we have there's a couple of doctors that are, a lot of the musicians go to. You know, most alcoholics, when they go to a doctor, they'll say, oh, yeah, maybe one or two drinks a week, you know. One or two to wake up, maybe, you know. But we don't tell them the truth. And because it was a musician doctor, my doctor was a string bass player, Ralph Gold. He would, boom, 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 you know, play the string bass. So he was a cool guy. And I said, Ralph, I think I got a problem with alcohol. He said, oh, if you truly have a problem with alcohol, there's only one thing that works. I said, what's that? He said, Alcoholics Anonymous. What else you got? So, come on, I lived in France, for Christ. So I tried acupuncture. It worked for a little while, you know. Works for a little while, but then the disease talks to you. It keeps telling you you don't have a disease. Nothing wrong with you. It'll be different this time. The insanity. Next, I tried hypnosis. You know, I just wasn't ready to give up my right to get up and throw up in the morning, you know. It was the only friend I had. So I knew that things were really bad now. And you can imagine this. I'm broke. All I can do is drink. My career has gone down the tubes. And I get a call from during a musician strike, me and my buddy took up golf a little bit. You know, Bill Wilson did it. I said, what the heck? So I started playing a little golf. And this famous disc jockey in L.A. heard that I was golfing. So he invites me over to a famous country club to play golf. I ain't got two nickels in my pocket. You know, I go over there feeling I'm walking on. Everybody's a millionaire then. I'm feeling like really low. And had a nice round of golf with him, and about the last three holes or so, I started feeling these chest pains. And I started feeling like weirdness, not pressure, not all of the classic symptoms, but weird. So I sat down after the round, had a beer, it went away. Next day I get up, I had a little session down in Santa Monica, and I take my drums and I'm setting them up, and boy, it comes back. Now I'm scared. And I call Ralph, my doctor. I said, Ralph, I'm starting to get this. He said, oh, he knew the way I lived. I did some other kind of stimulants other than alcohol. And he said, we better go see Dr. Steve, the piano player doctor. You could have something wrong that he can fix. I said, well, what kind of a doctor is he? He said, well, he's a cardiologist. I went, oh. So he takes me to see Dr. Steve, the piano player doctor. And Steve takes one look at me and he slaps me in the hospital. He says, you could have a blocked artery, because he kind of figured out this guy's a real player. You could have a blocked artery, you could have a lot of things, but we're going to take a look in your heart. You could have some major problems in there. So now it's 1986. My wife and I are celebrating our 20th anniversary. It's Thanksgiving weekend. And I'm in the hospital having an angiogram, where they squirt dye through your veins and check your heart out. And they found a massive blockage. So he said, you got to sign some papers, and they get you ready to have an angioplasty, where they stick a balloon. This is before stents, too, 86. They stick a balloon and pop the vessel that's clogged. They open it up. So now in this preparing for this angioplasty, they give you some kind of hospital dope. You know, you're like, you're awake for this thing. You have TV monitors up there in the cath lab. Me and the doc are joking around. We're having some laughs and stuff. You know. But whatever they gave me to get me ready for this thing, it was so good I didn't ask what it was. That's how good it was. But, you know, I mean, they could cut your damn leg off and you wouldn't care. I mean, this. So he's in there fooling around in my heart, and he says, oh, we found a blockage. So I'm going to pop that balloon in there. You're going to be fine. So he says, here we go. And the nurse is saying, he's going, he's going, he's gone. I died for a minute. It's not that rare in rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. A lot of us have overshot the mark. Come on, guys. So anyway, you know, they finished the procedure. It was successful and everything. And it's, you know, holiday, Thanksgiving weekend. So on the way out, I said to that doctor, I said, come on, man, you know me. What can I do? He said, well, you can never do that stimulant thing. I said, I don't like that stuff anyway. I said, but you know, I am the creative type, and this marijuana really has, oh. So he says to me, he says, well, a recent study finds that marijuana speeds up the heart rate. I said, okay, I'll be careful. I said, what about alcohol? He said, well, there's been a recent study that one glass of white wine a day is really good for the circulation. I went, oh, hallelujah. So my buddy sends his limo service. He had a company, and he sends a car to take us home. After all, I had a near-death experience, 20th anniversary, Thanksgiving. Takes me home in a limo, and there's a car phone. This is before cell phones, so I had to use it. I pick up the car phone, and I call my dope dealer. I get a little bag of weed. I'm the creative type, you know. And then I stopped at the liquor store and got two bottles of circulation. I wanted to make sure I had that covered. Drinking on the way home from a hospital. That's what we do. That's what we do. And for the next 5 years, I ate nothing but fish and vegetables. I ran around Lake Hollywood every morning. And I had one glass of white wine, and I hit off the joint. That was it. Then the disease starts talking to you again. Come on. You can have a couple of hits, you know. It took some time. It took 5 years or more. I don't even remember, but it took a while. This disease is relentless. It just keeps telling you it's going to be different. And after a while, you have to give into it. So I knew there was nothing left but Alcoholics Anonymous. So I drank with this little comedian guy, and he used to drink red wine. pineapple juice and coffee. Red wine for the buzz, pineapple juice to stay healthy, and coffee to stay awake. So I see little Sandy. I said, what happened? You don't have the red wine there anymore. He says, yeah, I give it up. I'm going to AA. And I went, uh-oh. So I watched him. I watched him for a while. I said, would you take me to one of those meetings? So he said, sure. Here's my Eskimo. He takes me to the Comedy Store on Sunset Boulevard at a Wednesday afternoon 5 o'clock rush hour meeting. And I go in. He says, you'll feel right at home, man. It stinks of stale beer and cigarettes from the night before. You'll feel right at home. I said, yeah, you're right, probably. So I go in, and there's a trumpet player on the stage. He's the speaker that day, and I didn't even know he was sober. And I took a commitment. I brought food. I brought that nice celery sticks with the dip and all of that stuff. Took a commitment. I got into it. One night a week, I can do this, So I took a dirty 30, dirty 60, and a dirty 90, because I didn't know you couldn't smoke weed. I used to smoke a joint on the way in, had one rolled for the way out. It made the speakers a whole lot more funny. But while I was there, I heard, no, it's everything from the neck up. So this was September, and we're getting near the end of the year, and I said, January the 2nd, my sobriety date, I said, I like this. Why don't I give this a try? So January the 2nd was my grandmother's birthday as well. I said, I'm going to do this for my grandmother, and for me, of course. But I've never been sober, really. So why don't I see what it's like? So New Year's Eve, I worked with the band. I had 20 joints rolled up in a cigarette pack. I had a 2-gram vial of you-know-what. But I had a bottle of non-alcoholic champagne because I wasn't drinking, damn it. So I got up the next day, I licked my wounds, and then I started going to meetings. January the 2nd, I started going to 2, 3. I couldn't be alone with myself. When I was new, my mind was such a mess. It was just such a mess. I couldn't be alone. All I thought about was drinking and drinking and drinking. I'm too much pain. So now I'm going to 2, 3 meetings a day. And I'm liking it. The obsession was lifted. I'm not thinking about it. I'm not thinking about anything other than, let me go to the next meeting. I like those people. I'm smiling. I'm laughing. I'm feeling good about life again. And my wife was really happy with that, too. And now I'm there 29 days. And we had our convention up there. The San Fernando Valley had their convention. And the ladies at Chandler Lodge, God bless them, they were wonderful. They saw me come in all crushed up, and they just heaped a lot of love on me. And I was at the convention Sunday morning in the spiritual breakfast. I didn't know you needed a ticket. So I'm out in the hallway about to explode with another resentment. I'm the king of resentments. And the girls see me out there like going, what do you mean you need a ticket to go to a spiritual meeting? So they came out, and they took one of the girls' tickets along. They came out, went to the ladies' room, and snuck me in. So I'm in the back of this 3,000 people in a big ballroom, and at the table in front of us is this man that I'd seen around AA. It was Scott Redmond. And I liked the way he handled himself, and I asked him to be my sponsor that day. And, I found out from his wife later on. He said, I'm kind of busy, I have more sponsors. And she gave him a shot. She told me, she gave him a shot. She said, you better sponsor this guy. He looks like he really means it. So he took me on as a sponsee. He said, here's what I want you to do. I want you to call me every day for 7 days. And if you skip a day, you're going to have to start all over again. And I'd like you to get up in the morning and say this simple prayer. I'm powerless. My life's unmanageable, but I know you're going to restore me to sanity. So today I'm yours. What I didn't know was he had me working those first 3 steps. It's kind of hard to drink when you're working those first 3 steps, if you mean them. So I did the 7 days. We got to know each other, doing the prayer. Everything's getting nice. Now I'm starting to see some guys that ain't sticking around. I'm 47 years old when I get here. And I said, oh, my God, these guys are going out. If I go out, I'll never find my way back. Then some old timer got in my face and he said, "Hey, kid, you'll drink before you do your four step." Thank God I'm a retaliator. So I called Scott up. I said, "Hey, this old timer got in my face. Told me I'll never do my, I want to do my four step." He says, "Great, come on." So that's, I believe that was the day that my journey really began. You know, went up to Scott's place. We had, you know, kitchen table, big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, pot of coffee, one drunk talking to another. That's what we do here. That's what we do. He read chapter 5 to me. Got done with chapter 5. And you know what? Let me stop. A, B's, and C's, the three pertinent ideas. C, that God could and would have sought. There's our bottom line. That's it. God could and would have sought. Don't have to find them. Just got to keep seeking them. How beautiful is that? We got to page 63 where it's the third step prayer, and he said, "You ready to take that third step prayer formally?" And I said, "Absolutely." He said, "All right, let's get on our knees and lock arms." Here's this guy I just met. I'm on my knees with him, and we're locking arms, and we're taking the third step prayer formally. "God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties." Now, what are they? I'm going to find this out in this fourth step. "Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy love, thy power, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always." I got off my knees with this man that I was just getting to know. I felt like my nightmare was over. I felt like I had a shot at this deal. It was, the big book even talks about it. It said, when we do this with a humble effort, an effect, sometimes a very great one, was felt at once. Every time I do that with a new man, pretty serious stuff. It was beyond hippie deep, I'll tell you, you know, the hippie edge. That third step prayer set it off. I got a disease that's motivated by self and fear. When I'm not thinking about myself, I'm thinking about myself. I'm driven by 100 forms of fear, fancy to real. That means if I don't have a real one, I'll just make one up, you know. So it was really important to me that I got this stuff started. Now he said, "Okay, now let's get some paper out. Here comes the good stuff. We're going to do the inventory thing. Put resentments at the top, draw some lines down the side across the top." He says, "Got any resentments?" I said, "Geez, not that I can think of." "So what about that guy in England that screwed you out of all that money?" "Oh, yeah, him. Put his name down." "Okay, the next, why did you have the resentment?" "The cause." "Well, he promised me pay for work. I worked, he didn't pay." "Good, put that down. Next column. Now, how did you, having this resentment, how did it affect you?" I said, "What do you mean, how did..." He said, "Look on the bottom of page 64 of our big book where it says, when we're in this phase of resentment, it affects our self-esteem, our pocketbook, our ambition, our personal relationship, and our sex. Did it affect your self-esteem?" "Yep, thought I was a loser." "Did it affect your pocketbook?" "Were you listening?" "Did it affect your ambition?" "Yeah, maybe the next band I'm in, I'm going to get screwed again." "Did it affect your personal relationships?" "Well, I couldn't say this guy's name without an expletive behind it." "Did it affect your sex?" I said, "Everything does." He goes, "Great, you got a five-bagger right there." But just think about it. When your self-esteem, pocketbook, ambition, personal relationship are tied up in resentment, you're kind of busy. There's no time for fun anymore. It's, oh. So he says, "Now here comes the good part. I want you to turn the paper over. And on the top, I want you to write, now what is the fault in Denny that if God would come along and remove it, he would no longer have this resentment?" "The fault in me? Jeez." I said, "Well, wait a minute. I was doing great in New York before I meet." He said, "Look, we're not taking his inventory. You're the drunker. Take a look at it. Good, hard look." So I said, "All right. I guess... there's millions of dollars floating around. I'm working on a hippie handshake. I don't have a contract. I guess that would make me irresponsible." Boom. There's my first character defect. Now, when I'm irresponsible, it's usually because I'm afraid to go to the guy about it. So there we have fear of confrontation. When I got fear of confrontation, then I say to myself, well, I know how to handle this. I just freeze him right out of my life, and I go to silent scorn. When I'm in silent scorn, why don't I mess with him on the way out? So I'll go to emotional blackmail and character assassination. You know, a lot of these terms were handed to me by Scott Redmond. Bob knows them as well as I do. And they're brilliant points, though, how the alcoholic thinks, you know. So in one entry into my fourth step, I'm learning so much about myself. Just one entry. So I went home and started working on it. Did that second list that we do, the fear inventory. All we have to do is ask God to remove our fear and turn our attention as to what he would have us do or be instead. And then it's one of my favorite lines in a big book. Right at the end of that sentence, it says, when we do this, immediately we commence to outgrow the fear. It doesn't have the power to send me back to that bar that I drank in. You know, so I put my fears down. And then the sexual inventory. And the sexual inventory is more than just a sex. We come here with some stuff we're not too proud of. And that had to be put on paper, too, so we can give it all to God. Got to hand it all off to God and let him deal with it. So the sexual inventory is such a beautiful inventory for relationships, business relationships, all kinds of stuff. You know, where was I selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate? That's easy. Everywhere. How could I have unjustifiably aroused suspicion, bitterness, or jealousy? My wife used to know any time I left to go on a concert tour in another continent somewhere, alcohol comes into the picture, anything's possible. Yeah, plenty of suspicion, bitterness, and jealousy. So I had to get all this stuff down because I'm going to bunch up all my resentments, my fears, and unsolvable sexual problems. I'm going to hand them off to God because I'm doing a terrible job of managing these. So finally get it done. Five, eight months it took me to write this thing. Go back to Scott. We get on our knees again. We bring God into the room with the third step prayer, and I read him my inventory. We laugh, we cried. He fell asleep a few times, you know. I felt like I'd just taken a shower on the inside. I really felt like something major had happened, you know. And I opened up all those old wounds and put sterile solution in and let them heal permanently. So I was thrilled with the progress I made. Then it was time to go back to, I went home, did 6 and 7, made my 8-step list, and it was time to start making some amends. So I go back to Pennsylvania, and I'm going to go back there to make amends to my family. My grandparents and my father had already passed. My mom was still alive. So I go home, and the first thing I do when I'm traveling, and I'm kind of new, I'm probably around 2 years or something, I call AA, where's the meeting? Well, you know where the meeting is, the church that I stole money from. So I'm in this nursery room where I was brought as a baby, and there's the 7 founding fathers of the church there, my granddad's picture there. So I'm making amends to my granddad for the way I tended bar at his funeral. We didn't have bars in my family, but when I was drinking, we had a bar at his funeral. It wasn't a real bar, but, you know, so I made amends. I went up to Sunday service then when the collection plate came around. I had to pay all those quarters back with interest and without a note. So you don't usually see a big bill like that in the collection plate. And then after the service, we went up to the cemetery, and my dad, my granddad, my grandmother, and this family plot. And I walked up to the tombstones to make amends to them, and I just lost it. I was so ashamed at what I'd been given and what I'd done with it. I said, nah, enough of this. Came home from there and really got busy. Got busy in all the work that we do in AA, sponsoring, going to meetings, taking commitments, doing what we do around here. A couple of years into that, my mom calls me up. She says, oh, the doctors think I have an aneurysm in my aorta, and I've had it for a long time, and they think it's going to I'm going to have a problem, and they want to do surgery, and I'm scared. I said, oh, Mom, if only you were an alcoholic. We have ways of dealing with this fear. So I tell her what we do, and we're talking every day on the phone. I'm getting ready for this thing, and I'm getting ready. She had a big team of doctors at the Philadelphia University there at the hospital, best team of doctors in the East Coast. So it's coming close to the time. She's ready. She's ready for this surgery. She's 74 at the time. And I'll be damned if they didn't have to postpone it. There was something happening in their scheduling or something. They postponed it for 30 days, and she went to absolute terror. So I had to give her the best that you guys give me on a daily basis. Get her ready again, fly home for the surgery. My sister and I were there. My kid brother couldn't get down, and we thought everything was going to be fine. We kissed her goodbye and wheeled her into surgery, and she didn't make it. It was just too bad of a, too brutal of a surgery. So I was up at the house the next day, still in shock, and I'm going through her things. We're going to plan the service and all. I open up this journal that she had when I was getting her ready for the surgery. In the journal, how it said how his son, her son, and his wonderful program of Alcoholics Anonymous made the last days of her life so much better than they would have been. I'm overpaid. So I was the last one with my mom at the funeral home, and I had my five-year medallion, and I put my five-year medallion in her hand, closed her hand, closed the coffin. I want to remember where I left that thing. And then the next morning, we put her in the ground next to my dad and her parents. I stood there a different man, stood there proud. Proud of what I allowed you to make of me. I could have missed it very easily, as so many do. So coming home from that experience, I realized, geez, now I got to make amends to that guy from England, and I have to make amends without asking for the check. And Dr. Paul helped me with a lot of that. So he sent me to Sermon on the Mount, and we talked a lot about how you resentments would come back, the prayer of forgiveness, all this great stuff. He really helped me through that tough period when the resentment kept coming back at me, and I've done everything that I knew how to do. So Paul really helped me with that. God bless him. I love that guy. Then we turn on the TV one day, and I see that my old boss in England just lost, his wife dies from breast cancer. We knew she was sick, but nobody knew she was that sick. I picked up the phone. I called him. I said, oh my God, I'm so sorry. What can I do, you know? I didn't know that I was capable of doing that. That was the ice, you know, around my heart. It no longer was there. I was compassionate enough that I could call this guy after. And there were a lot of years we didn't talk. It was just bitter, bitter, bitter. And I'd made a couple of times. I attempted at amends with him. But you never know, a guy that big. So now we get invited to a memorial that they're having for his wife in New York. So I say to my wife, I said, let's go. It's part of my amends. So we fly to New York and at this big fancy church. I said, well, they won't know we're even there. But I'll know it. It's part of my amends. So we get to the back, and they usher us right up to set us across from the family. We had a good long talk afterwards, and I knew that my amends were understood and taken. Then we thought, we better go over and see how he's doing, because they were married 29 years or something like that when she passed away. Another long-term relationship. So I said, let's go to England and see how he's doing, being alone. So we go over there. We're hanging out with him and patching up the past. And he said, you know, I think we're going to reissue that music that you did a long time ago, the beginnings of the band, very beginning of the band. And we're going to make a film about it. And I went, oh, that's nice. But why would people, if they bought it 30 years ago, why are they going to buy it a second time, you know? He said, you used to have a camera. I had this, like, video camera backstage and the goofy stuff in the dressing room, you know, the candid stuff. He said, do you still have that footage? And I said, yeah. He said, well, we'd like to use it in the documentary. I said, sure, it's yours. So I sent it to him. He sent me a check. I didn't have to ask, you know, a little one. So things are coming true now. So So now I start seeing some promo on this thing, you know. And I go to my buddy that runs the record company. I said, hey, man, what's this thing going to do? He says, well, we're not sure, but we're shipping 2 million units tomorrow. I went, oh, no, I can't watch this money go by again. And so now I got a new sponsor. Scott passed away. And actually, we separated, remained friends, but separated that relationship before he died. And I was with him at the end. He was... Anyway, I had a new sponsor, and I said to this new guy, he was a piano player, another musician, same amount of time as we were sponsoring each other. I said, what do I do here? He says, well, if I was you, I'd write the guy a letter and tell him how you feel. I said, I can't do that. He says, why? I said, because I made a deal with God. I said, don't let me drink again, and I don't care if I never see a penny from that. So he thinks about it for a minute. He goes, well, you got to remember, God's old, and he moves slow. So I said, all right, I'll write the letter. So I did he says 15 drafts. I remember 3, you know, piano players always. So anyway, I got the poison out of it, and I read it to him, my then sponsor. And he said, I think you said what you wanted to say. Why don't you see what God's got to say about it? And I did. Talk to God about it. And you know, when the longer that relationship, that higher power thing that we get here, I mean, you just can't beat that. After a while, the answer comes here, not here. And so he says to me, send it. I sent this thing off. And I know that the man picked up the letter, he read it, picked up the phone, he was in tears. Denny, I'm so sorry. I had no idea my business people rolled over you that way. We talked. I almost killed myself over this. He said, how did you live with this for 28 years? I said, well, not very gracefully. I'm in AA. You know? At the end of it, he said, I'm going to make this right. Today, our future looks a little bit brighter, I'll tell you. But just without the weight of that thing that almost killed us. When I called my wife at work, she screamed at work. Somebody thought that all her worker friends thought somebody died in the family. Like, I mean, we've been living with that for 28 years. Pretty miraculous that the thing that brought me here came full circle. Full circle. Everything about this program is miraculous. That's all there is to it. And Dr. Paul, I used to love Dr. Paul. I'm going to steal something from him. He used to say, I hope you have a good case of alcoholism. Because alcoholism is the only disease known to mankind. When you catch it, you become a better person. How about that? So I loved when he said that. And all we have to do to keep it is to give it away. And all it insists of us is that we be happy, joyous, and free. That's kind of good news for a drunk like me. Happy, joyous, and free. How can I be happy, joyous? I got bar tabs in the valley, you know. I figured it out over time. Happy, joyous, and free. A life free of resentments, fears, and sexual problems. It's a damn four-step. That's why they talk about it in the big book as building an archway through which we pass a free man. That's my message. The fourth step did more for me than anything I've ever done in my life. It was the most profound event in my life. And it's so profound, I'm still talking about it 28 years later. I thank you guys so much for listening. I love you all. Hope to see you around all weekend. Thank you.